The Citi Double Cash Card presents tips for talking sports at the office. Number 8, be informed.
I'm going to list some random stats that don't really mean anything.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. I'm nodding, but I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's not working.
Wouldn't it be great if everyone said what they meant? The Citi Double Cash Card does. It lets you earn double cash back with 1% when you buy and 1% as you pay. The Citi Double Cash Card. Double means double.
This is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Monday, May 15th, 2017. I'm Buster Olney. Josh Macri is the producer of the show. And Josh, a big announcement today. Today's the day when I think we can no longer claim small sample size for the 2017 season. Some teams have played as many as 40 games, about a quarter of the season. What do you think?
Yeah, it's about that time, Buster, with Memorial Day fast approaching. It's getting to the point where we can't claim small sample size anymore. I think you're right.
No, and we'll have to ask Keith Law about that because the Twins are a first-place team. The Cubs are a fourth-place team. And the Cardinals never seem to lose anymore. The Nationals might run away with the National League East. The Astros had a big weekend in the Bronx, even as their players celebrated Derek Jeter Sunday. And on today's podcast, uniform and logo expert Todd Radom ranks the 20th best logo of all time and gets grilled about whether he had a hand in the Jeter ceremonies. Let's get to it.
It's more than just a conversation. It's the Weekly Dish with Keith Law on Baseball Tonight.
And Keith Law scouts for ESPN. He's on television for ESPN. He writes for ESPN. He also is the author of the new book, Smart Baseball. And Keith, that makes you the perfect person. I love the title of the book makes it perfect to come up with segues every week about how that applies to what we're going to talk about. Josh and I have a lot of fun on the podcast where if anything's not going as we expect or, you know, I expect, like the Blue Jays getting off to a bad start, I'll just go small sample size. You know, it's not enough sample size. Quite literally, how would you define small sample size in baseball? How would you apply it?
Well, so in general, when readers ask me, like in chats or on Twitter, they ask the question, you know, is this for real? Yeah, is this sustainable? Usually I say, don't pay much attention to anything until about Memorial Day, just as a really rough rule of thumb. By that point, you've at least got enough to react to. Now, that may still not mean it's going to stay that way for the rest of the season, but at least there you've gotten out of the really fluky stuff, the 50 at-bats or so, where somebody's just performed way out of line with their track record. But when I'm also trying to determine whether I think something is real, and, you know, in the absence of like a physical change, someone gets healthy or someone changes a delivery or something like that. But if we're saying looks like the same player, but the stats are totally different one way or another, usually what I'm looking for is a discrepancy within their individual stats, whether it's whether it's a player, even whether it's a team. When a team is winning, you know, a team is has a winning record, but they've been outscored so far in the season. When a player is seems to be performing way above expectations for him, but then you look and he's got a, you know, batting average on balls in play that's way above anything he's ever posted in his career. You know, the guy with the 400 BABIP, that's not going to last the rest of the season. So I often try to look for those things, particularly in big leaguers. In minor leaguers, you might see bigger shifts season to season. It's a little less surprising to see that kind of growth, but in the big leagues, I'd say, 90% of the time, they are who we thought they were. And it's the default assumption that nothing has changed is usually going to be the right one.
All right, with that in mind, some teams now have played 40 games where pretty much all the teams across the baseball landscape are reaching the quarter pole. So I want to ask you about some teams and some players and get your observations here. First, the Houston Astros. They are absolutely threatening to run away with the American League West. They're 7.5 games ahead in that division. And I think, Keith, that the folks at Sports Illustrated have a chance to have the greatest cover in the history of magazines, right? How many years ago was it? 3 years ago when they had the cover that said Houston Astros, the 2017 champions. I saw them over the weekend. They won 3 out of 4 against the Yankees. And the amazing thing is, before Sunday night, I don't think their lineup has really all come together. Like they don't, it's not like they're riding this wave of a bunch of guys mashing the ball. That's still to come. And I do think that that's a team with their front office and their window of opportunity now that will be aggressive in adding a starting pitcher and a reliever before the trade deadline. Maybe Kelvin Herrera, if the Royals decide to become sellers. This team absolutely is a World Series champion. Or, Keith, do you think it's a small sample size?
No, I think they're legit. I think that I thought coming into the season they were going to win the division. I thought they were probably going to win the division pretty handily because I didn't see a team that was particularly close to them. I think they've probably outperformed their peripheral so far this season, but I wouldn't really change any forecast for them. Like, I still think they're going to win the division by a wide margin. I still think they're going to be very tough in October. And I agree with you that because not only because the front office will be aggressive, but because they still have a pretty good farm system. They have a lot of assets they could potentially trade. It would help them. The one thing is if Francis Martes gets healthy, pitches well in AAA for a little bit, he'll give them some options because, one, he could headline a trade for just about anybody if he's healthy. But, two, he could also come up and be a guy out of the bullpen for them. And maybe then they only need to trade for one piece instead of two. I mean, he's a starter by trade. I'm just thinking what's more likely for him to come up and contribute this year. More likely he comes up and helps as a middle guy, maybe a bridge guy to get to the ninth or someone they use in high leverage situations. More likely he does that this season than comes up and is inserted directly into the rotation.
In hearing you define small sample size and some of the possible outliers on that, a name that absolutely jumped to mind, Charlie Morton mm-hmm. of the Astros. And I don't know, shame on me for not digging into this to find out who the exact person was who looked at Charlie Morton, who I've always thought of sort of being a ham and egg sinker ball pitcher, and seeing something more in him. A fascinating conversation we had with Astros manager A.J. Hinch last night, where he told us that when they signed Charlie Morton, they told him, look, we just want you to throw the hell out of the ball. Because he was a guy, 90 to 92 mile an hour sinker. And they told him, no, throw it as hard as you can. Don't worry about trying to be savvy and getting your way through the lineup the first time through. Throw it as hard as you can. And last night, Keith, against the Yankees, he was clocked as high as 99 miles per hour. His pitches are moving all over the place. He struck out seven batters at one point. And AJ's told us about when they first sat down with Charlie Morton after signing him, Charlie Morton looked at AJ and said, why'd you give me a two-year deal? Like, why would you invest a multi-year deal in me based on how I'm doing? And AJ told Charlie, and the Astros were telling Charlie, we think you're a lot better than maybe you think you are. And certainly right. At this point, he is.
He had those, I think it was four starts for the Phillies last year before he suffered the hamstring injury that ended his season. And he was throwing like this. He was suddenly throwing much harder without losing any life on his fastball. Because he's a guy who, like 5 years ago, would show mid to upper 90s, maybe not 99, but 96 certainly, on a four-seamer. And then switched to a sinker, lower velocity, but obviously he was getting ground balls, just became a better big league pitcher. And everything was happening at the same time. And so it was four starts, and it would be exactly what you said. Well, this is just a small sample. Well, then I heard in spring training this year, too, that it was the same. He came back and was exactly the same guy that he'd been last spring. That's why I threw him on my list of breakout candidates for this year, saying, no, this guy's legitimately a different pitcher. It's different stuff. The command is still not, obviously, where you'd like it to be, but if it with that stuff, with that velocity and movement, if he had good command, he'd be a number one starter. And he's not that yet. I guess it's still possible he could get there. But I absolutely think he's an above-average starter, and I think he's the kind of guy you're happy to roll out there against good lineups, too. That is the kind of stuff that you can roll out there in a playoff rotation and be very comfortable running him up against the better lineups in the league.
Yeah, let's keep in mind, if he continues to do this, they get to the postseason, he'll be the number three or four. It's not like he needs to be the number
right.
one. They've got Dallas Keuchel and Lance McCullers and maybe somebody they trade for during the season to do that. So Charlie Morton, definitely an eye-opener. The Chicago
and
Cubs.
And Keuchel, by the way, can I just say, and I think we talked about this maybe when we were in Bristol together, Keuchel looks like 2015 Keuchel again, too. And that's another one where I'm in. The mechanics look restored, and the results are lining up with what he did the year he won the Cy Young.
Yeah, and when we talked to AJ yesterday, he said that presence on the mound, that That guy who's on the mound basically saying, I'm coming after you. That's what we're seeing in Dallas Keuchel this year, you know, back to where he was in 2015. Let's talk about the Cubs. They're now below 500. I'm absolutely shocked by where they are, 18 and 19. They were never below 500 at any point last season. Their defense so far, mediocre to bad. And this is an amazing statistic to me. Last season, the Cubs converted 93% of fly balls into outs, the best rate in Major League Baseball. This season, they rank 27th. And look, there are a lot of reasons why they are where they are, but certainly the defense is part of it.
The defense is part of it. The starting pitching largely has taken a step back. Some expected, like I said all along, I thought Kyle Hendricks was going to, but that was a peak for him last year. Everything went right. He'd take a step back, but some maybe less expected. I mean, did anyone think Jake Arrieta would turn this average this quickly? I think we thought it would happen at some point. You know, if we were having a discussion of, do you give Jake Arrieta a 5 or 6 year deal? Yes. At some point in that deal, he's going to turn out to be average. He's going to wear down, et cetera. But I didn't predict it to happen this year. And I wouldn't have, if somebody asked me, what do you think Arrieta will be this year? I would have still said a well above average starter. The part that I think can turn around is I look up and down that offense and I could see 4 or 5 guys there who are way underperforming track record, expectations, skill set. Some is health. I know Addison Russell isn't completely healthy, but I mean, Kyle Schwarber's hitting, what, .180? This guy's a good hitter. He's a much better hitter than that. Russell's a much better hitter than he's shown. Contreras is a much better hitter than he's shown. Chris Bryant might be the only guy in that lineup so far who is performing in line with reasonable projections coming into the season, and that would give me hope if I were a Cubs fan. This is a team that at the very least should mash. Now, maybe the pitching and defense, the run prevention unit won't be what we thought it would be, but I could still see them winning that division on the strength of their offense and just average run prevention the rest of the season.
I agree with you. I think the Cubs will bounce back. One thing I would say about Contreras and Schwarber that we seem to be forgetting about them because they won the World Series last year, contributed to that. Both of these guys have about 100 games in the big leagues in the regular season. That's, you know, these are guys who are still learning, and we have to remember that. Jake Arrieta, you can't say the same thing about. He's now allowed 33 runs in 8 starts this season. Keith, he didn't allow his 33rd run in 2016 until July 8th. His stuff is flat to me. His command is certainly not on. To me, if I'm the Cubs and I'm watching Jake Arrieta, I mean, not only, let's face it, the Cubs are not going to be the team investing in a long-term deal in him, but it also would increase my push to add a starting pitcher watching what I'm seeing out of Arrieta because you don't know what he's going to be at the end of the year.
Wait, you're thinking, if you're the Cubs, you're still thinking postseason too. I mean, obviously now you're trying to think, well, we have to do more to win the division. But you're thinking October. What's your October rotation? All right, you know who your one is. Who's your two? Who's a two who you feel comfortable rolling out there against? You're seeing better lineups in October. That's typical. You'd expect to see that in the postseason. Who is that guy? I mean, we talked on Thursday. I said I'd heard they were scouting Zach Greinke very heavily back in March and that it was sort of an organizational push to look for starters with years of control remaining, so they would trade a couple of prospects, but get somebody who is more than just a rental, which is, you know, smart baseball, so to speak, and especially given some of the prospects they have. They got an Ian Happ who comes up, he homers, he was raking in AAA. I don't know that there's a place for him in the big leagues, or maybe he comes up and that frees them to trade Javi Baez, for example. You don't want to give those guys up for a rental. So I think they're doing the right thing. I don't have any idea which guy it'll be they settle on, but I do think they'll acquire somebody like a Greinke, but someone with multiple years of control remaining on his current deal. So they're dealing prospects, but they're getting a guy who locks into the rotation long-term as their number two or maybe even a future number one starter.
I thought that Joe Maddon's eruption on Saturday over having the slide rule applied to the Cubs in that loss, I think, there's certainly frustration for Maddon and other people around baseball when that rule is applied, but I think a lot of it is because of concern about the Cubs. If they were in the middle of a 10-game winning streak, you would not have seen that sort of reaction from Chicago. On the other end of that, the St. Louis Cardinals are playing great. They've got 18 wins in their last 24 games. It's the best record in Major League Baseball since April 17th, and their pitching has been terrific of late. How about Mike Leake? Seven games started, and, you know, again, applying small sample size, Keith, I almost look at his 2016 season as being a summer-long small sample size because he really didn't have the type of team he needed behind him to be effective. This year, it's a better defense behind him.
Yes, and this is the Mike Leake I think most people, the Cardinals included, thought they were signing. But I agree with you. I looked at last season and said, this doesn't seem like it was on him. The stuff was the same. Delivery was the same. I don't think his command was different at all, certainly not appreciably different, but he didn't get the help that he relies on from his defense. That's what he's always been. I remember seeing him at Arizona State, and it would be he would throw maybe five distinct pitches, but the money pitch for him was that two-seamer, 88, 89 inches, getting ground balls and a pitch you thought would break major league, like right-handers' bats at least, just run it right in on their hands, and guys would have a hard time elevating it, and he didn't get – but that approach only works if the guys behind you can catch the ball.
All right, let's talk about the Twins. Incredibly, as of today, first place in the American League Central. Their starters are ninth out of 30 teams in ERA at 3.96. It's tremendous work by this team so far this year. I still would apply small sample size to the Twins. What do you think?
Oh, big time. And what I was mentioning earlier when you asked about sort of when do I call small sample size on someone, I think they've still been outscored on the season. That's generally not a good indicator going forward. I would certainly rely on your run differential more than your one lost record at an early point in the season. Recognizing one blowout could really skew things, but look, this is not a good offensive team. This is not a good run prevention team either. They've got one guy in the lineup who's an above average hitter right now, and that's Miguel Sano, who looks like a budding superstar at this point. But you look at that rotation, and I mean, up and down, I see unsustainable ERAs. I see a lot of room for regression. And I think they're relying on, you know, Jose Berrios comes up. Is he really going to be the savior? I like Berrios as a prospect, but if this is the guy they're going to bank on to maybe boost the rotation going forward, he's not that. They're not going to trade for anyone. I don't think it would make the least bit of sense for them to start cashing in guys from the farm system to try to add. It sounds perverse, but the best thing that could happen for Derek Falvey and company would be if the Twins just play more to their level the next 2 months and give them the flexibility to trade the major league players away and continue to restock the farm system. They got the first pick in June and a couple high picks after that. They'll be able to crush the draft. Then go out, trade a few veterans for some prospects in July, and really accelerate the rebuild because they did not inherit a terrible farm system. There's still certainly talent there, but a summer like that can take them from sort of a middle-of-the-pack system to something that's top five in baseball.
Speaking of which, about the idea of becoming sellers, three teams that had started really badly this year in the last week sort of rose from the dead. The Rangers, six straight wins. They're almost back to 500, 19 and 20. The Royals have won four in a row. They're now 4.5 games out in the American League Central. The Blue Jays, five straight wins, now 6.5 games out. I'm going to pick one of the three teams just as a look at them as a team perhaps that I think maybe this is the start of a push. And I'm going to say the Rangers, okay? I think they're the best team of those three. I think they've got a lot of depth. I think they had some injuries at the start of the year, and I think they're starting to figure some things out. And we've seen this from the Rangers before, where they started slowly and then came back. What do you think?
So I think the Blue Jays are the best team of the three, but the Rangers are the best situated because of the division, because of the state of, you know, look, the Astros are way ahead of them, obviously. But looking at the rest of the division and if you're the Rangers thinking, can we at least get into a good wild card position? I like their competitive situation more than I like the Blue Jays situation. And the other thing is I think the Blue Jays are still not 100% healthy and may not be 100% healthy. And I guess I'm saying healthy, but I'm also including the age factor too, because, I mean, Jose Bautista has just looked old. I don't think that we can talk about foot injury is an excuse anymore. He may just not be a very good hitter at this point. He may have simply left his peak, and that's the end. Rangers, I think they're pretty close to healthy at this point. They're getting contributions from some young players who were simply not there last year or not contributing last year. The one thing I worry about with them is that they have cashed in so much young talent the last few years to build up, you know, obviously built several playoff teams. If they need help this summer, it's going to be difficult. There's not a lot they can trade, and there's nothing they can it's probably an exaggeration. There's not much they can call up to help. And the two guys I had ranked as their best pitching prospects coming into the season are both really off to mediocre starts in the minors. So, I mean, they're going to have to do it with the talent that's on the roster right now. I think that's possible. I think they could certainly end up maybe in the mid to upper 80s. That's probably the upper bound I would put on them. I don't think they can catch the Astros. I didn't think they were going to catch the Astros before they were seven games back in the division. Now I certainly don't think they can.
A big weekend for Bryce Harper. He agrees to a deal for 2018 for $21.625 million, and he threw out a lot of hits over the weekend, Keith. And I've told you before, I like to post on-pace numbers on Twitter, not because I think the player is going to wind up with those numbers, but because it gives you some context about just how hot the player is. Keith has some this morning. Bryce Harper not only hitting .384, he's on pace for 175 runs. 53 homers, 210 hits, and 127 walks. He's on pace to get on base about 350 times, okay? I'm not going to ask you about whether or not this is small sample size. I think you and I would both agree he's not going to wind up with those numbers. But I did find the timing of the signing to be interesting, and I do wonder, after what I've heard about Harper from his teammates the last couple of years, if by the time we get to the fall of 2018, Bryce Harper might think, you know what, I could go to New York. I could sign with the Yankees. I could sign with the Phillies. I might get a little bit more money, but is that really going to be what I want? Is that something that I'm going to be that's going to make me happy? And, look, I know he's got a good relationship with Mike Rizzo, the general manager. You and I both know that the Nationals owners are certainly capable of paying him a lot of money. And after hearing stories from teammates about how Bryce is kind of boxed in by his celebrity, I am starting to wonder if he might say to Scott Boras's agent, look, go make the best deal we can with the Nationals.
The thing I could see working against that is he's the potential record setter. If he gets to free agency, and it's him versus Machado, too, which probably adds to the competitive dynamic. That may be more about the agents involved than about the players. But I'm thinking the union, too, is probably dying for one of these guys to get to free agency and just destroy any previous mark for annual salary, for total contract value. I mean, I think either of those guys could go out to free agency and say, I want a 10-year deal. Now, they may not get it, but you're talking about young, and they're still both under 25. This is their age 24 season, I think, for both guys. They could reasonably say, sign me into my early 30s. That's not crazy. You've got guys reaching free agents this young. So I think there's going to be tremendous pressure on both of those guys to go to free agency and get a market salary as opposed to signing early. I agree with you, though. I was surprised that he signed the deal for 18 now, because although it was a record setter, so sure, he's happy and Boras is happy to do that. You know, would this not have been an unbelievable arbitration case? He could win the MVP again this year. He probably is so far. He's right back to where he was in 2015. You could certainly, if you wanted to say, well, this is a small sample size, but look at 2015. Could he do that the rest of the season? Clearly. He's clearly healthy. Whatever physically ailed him last year is over. So whether it was the shoulder or something else, he's back to MVP level. Imagine taking that guy into arbitration in his final year of eligibility with two MVP awards, an MVP award and an MVP type of season, maybe a World Series ring after this year to take to that. Could he have gotten a little bit more? Maybe it doesn't matter, but getting the most and raising the ceiling really matters to agents and matters tremendously to the union. And that's why I was surprised. That's why you were too, to see him sign that deal so early in the season.
Yeah. What a great payday for him, and what a great situation he's going to be in over the next 18 months. And it will be interesting to see, you know, where he takes this. And maybe Scott goes into free agency knowing that in the end he does wind up making a deal with the Nationals, or maybe he's going to actually seriously entertain conversations with teams like the Yankees and the Phillies. We'll just have to wait and see. Keith, we got about 30 seconds left. I wanted to get your thoughts on the Derek Jeter number retirement. I thought, again, that one of the coolest things I always like in these situations, and I covered when Cal Ripken broke the consecutive game record, is the reaction from the guys on the other side of the field. The Houston Astros players were all at the front of the dugout watching the whole thing. And I was reminded that among other players, Derek was always incredibly respected for his personality and his consistency and how he handled things. He certainly handled that great yesterday.
Yes, it was unfortunate the way the game game unfurled the way that it did. But I do think, I agree. I thought he handled it great. I thought the reactions from the other players, the comments from other players around the league, former teammates, were all tremendous. I saw the quote from Dick Groce, who was the Yankee scout who signed him, who I've met over the years. He went on to work for the Brewers for a long time. Just to see that, to recognize, to have recognized so many people who were involved in his development as a player, too. Like, that's the part that I particularly appreciate.
Keith, thanks for doing this. Great to talk with you.
Yeah, my pleasure.
We'll be back in a moment with Todd Radom, the chief executive of our uniform and logo quiz. But first, buying tickets to sports and concerts can be way too complicated, but there's a better, simpler way to buy with SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the smartest, easiest way to get tickets to live events. With SeatGeek's seamless mobile experience, you can buy and sell tickets in just two taps. SeatGeek helps you find the best seats at the best prices, fully guaranteed. There's nothing quite like seeing your favorite team or musician in person, and SeatGeek will get you closer to the action for a great value. SeatGeek is designed to make your ticket buying experience easier than ever. SeatGeek saves you time and money by searching multiple ticket sites to compare prices and find amazing deals. And to get you the most bang for your buck, SeatGeek grades every ticket based on value to help you immediately identify the best seats that fit your budget. Plus, every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. Make SeatGeek your go-to app for finding the best deals on every type of ticket, from sports and concerts to comedy and theater. Best of all, my listeners get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. To get your $20 rebate on tickets, download the SeatGeek app, go to the Settings tab, and click Add a Promo Code, and a promo code BBTN. That's BBTN for baseball tonight. And SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. Download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code BBTN today.
I'm Eric Carabell on the latest fantasy-focused baseball podcast, the awesome Tristan Cockcroft, and I discuss a big weekend preview with pitchers to watch, plus the unfortunate Freddie Freeman news, Miguel Cabrera and Gregory Polanco are hurt, close a carousel, and you're happy.
Todd Radom is the chief executive of our uniform and logo quiz. He is a graphic artist whose work can be seen on ball fields all across America and at his website, toddradom.com. And Todd, before we get started, I just want to say I've known you for more than a couple of decades. And yes, it's true, I have no sense of style. We've established that on our uniform and logo quiz. But I have gotten a sense of what your work looks like. And so it's time for a cross-examination. Todd, I must ask you, was that beautiful sleeve patch that the Yankees wore in the uniforms on the night that Derek Jeter had number two retired, was that your work?
On advice of my counsel, I will plead the Fifth Amendment to blah, 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 blah.
Okay, on to the next question. What about that Monument Park jacket logo? Was that your work, sir?
On the advice of counsel, Senator, I've been advised by my...
I don't like the stonewalling. That's all I'm going to say. I don't like the stonewalling. We have to move on, Todd. If it was your work, congratulations. What a cool night. All right, before we get to the uniform and logo quiz, this week you were unveiling the 20th greatest logo of all time. What do you got?
That's right, Buster. Number 20 on our list of greatest MLB logos comes to us from Charm City, Baltimore, Maryland, and it's the Orioles swinging cartoon
bird. Nice, the ornithological bird, right? It's the ornithological bird, right?
No, it's the predecessor. This is the one that was used from 1966 to 91. Why does this merit a spot in our top 30? It's well-designed. It's nicely balanced. It's instantly recognizable as opposed to that ornithological bird. And it's associated with the greatest players and teams in Orioles franchise history. The Cartoon Bird's 1966 debut coincided with the O's first World Series title. Sometimes it's better to be lucky than good, right? The bird is happy, it's up for a challenge, it's ready to take on the world, and it's the perfect visual symbol for a franchise that was then on the move. It was created by an artist named Paul Carlson, who worked at Quartet Films. Get this. They also created the Jolly Green Giant, the Ham's Beer Bear, and Tony the Tiger of cereal fame. Its replacement, the ornithologically correct Oriole that you, Buster, you have such warm feelings for, seems cold by comparison. It's too detailed. It's too tight. This one works. It's linked with multiple winners and multiple Hall of Famers. So there you have it. Number 20 on our list of greatest MLB logos, the Baltimore Orioles cartoon bird.
All I can say is I feel sorry for Brooks Robinson. I feel sorry for Jim Palmer. I feel sorry for Mike Flanagan, all those Oriole greats who had to play under the cartoon logo. And I will neither confirm nor deny that although I have not had kind words in this podcast about the cartoon bird, I'm not going to answer the question whether or not I actually have one of those hats in my office here as I speak with you. Yes, exactly. Todd, or Josh, what do you think? Do you
like this,
number 20?
I love the cartoon bird. I like it better than the ornithological bird, Buster, that you have so much fondness for. It's more, not to get all technical like Todd, but it's more baseball-y, you know? It's fun. It's cool. It's got a bat in its hand. It's not just a bird standing there like a dope.
I like that baseball term. And if I'm not mistaken, when the Orioles opted to phase that fun bird out in the late 80s, Fred Lynn, who was then with the Orioles, had some very harsh words for the dopey cartoon bird. But then the Orioles in 1988 start the season with just, you know, an awful, awful losing streak. And look, they bring back the happy bird. They're back in the postseason. So there you go.
Oh, well. I know that Buck Showalter probably agrees with you.
Didn't make me Johnny Super Scout.
Yeah. Right, okay. Todd, all right, let's get to this week's quiz. I'm leading Josh by one, and by rule, because I'm the defending champion, I have to answer first.
All right, boys, here we go. And since it's all things Jeter, of course last week we discussed Derek Jeter's number retirement that took place yesterday. So here's this week's question. Which expansion franchise has retired the most uniform numbers? Is it A, the Mets, B, the Angels, C, the Royals, or D, the Astros? Mets, Angels, Royals, Astros. Who is it?
Wow. I'm going to go D, Astros, although I'm a little concerned about the Mets because they love their lore and they certainly have had a lot of great players go through there.
I don't think it's the Mets, unless we're including them retiring the name Shea, which is not a number. But so I will go, because I'm just picturing the wall in my head.
Okay.
I'm going to go with the Angels, because I feel like I see a lot of numbers on that wall. So I'm going to go B, the Los Angeles Angels.
Buster is opening up a lead here.
Baby! Woohoo!
Astros, who have retired many, many numbers, 10 by my count, but this is always a slippery thing because of the fact that Jackie Robinson is retired, of course, by every MLB franchise. But the Astros honor, you know, guys like Larry Durker and, you know, guys who are meaningful to the franchise, but not necessarily enshrined in Cooperstown.
I think that if this were an actual baseball season at this point, internally, Josh's front office would be having conversations about whether to sell off and rebuild and try to get comeback for 2018.
Small sample size.
I'm up by two.
Buster. Small sample
size.
Yeah,
there you go. Todd, thanks for doing this. And we're continue our investigation about what work you did on the Derek Jeter sleep patch.
Thank you, guys.
Last week, Derek Jeter sat down with Carl Ravitch in advance of the night when his uniform number 2 was retired. Here is a small portion of that.
Given that we're having the number retired, can you go back to when you were growing up, your first sort of memories of being a baseball player, Little League, whatever it was, throwing in the backyard with your dad?
I was, as far back as I can remember, I was a Yankee fan. My mom's got 13 brothers and sisters. Every summer I'd spend at my grandparents' house in New Jersey. My grandmother was a huge Yankee fan, so I would sit up at night with her and watch the games. And that's where the love affair came about with the Yankees. And I guess the first thing I can remember is playing on a Little League team, and we were the Tigers.
The Tigers.
And I couldn't have been more disappointed. You know, I can't tell you anything else about that season, but I was playing for the Tigers.
Was there a Yankees team in that league?
No, there wasn't, which eased the mind a little bit.
What do you remember about watching the Yankees then? And who were the big guys? Who were the players? What did you like about it?
Obviously, the pinstripes stood out first and foremost. I think when you're young, it's a visual love affair. And it was Winfield. Dave was my guy. You know, I thought he was larger than life. But, you know, those were the years, Donnie, you know, Willie Randolph. I used to watch all the highlights. So I tried to learn as much as I could about the past Yankee teams. And I just couldn't think of a better organization to play for.
When you say you always loved the Yankees and you watched Winfield, was that when you think the seed was planted? Or did you at that age, what are you at that age?
I mean, I was 4 or 5
So you're not
years
thinking
old.
I'm going to be a baseball player, are you?
As long as I could remember, that's the only thing I've wanted to do.
There's a great deal of structure and preparation and confidence that you have. At that stage, you're beginning this baseball career as a professional. Did you always believe that you would end up at the major league level?
No. I always, in the back of my mind, I did. When I first signed, you know, I was drafted when I was 17. I signed left day after my 18th birthday, and never really been away from home with the exception of family trips to my grandparents' house, and had never really struggled when it comes to playing baseball. I went to rookie ball and I struggled, and it was rough. And you know, everyone has a roommate. I didn't have a roommate at the beginning because I signed late. I'm by myself, struggling for the first time, calling home crying, saying I should have gone to school. Can I give the money back and start all over? But my parents were there, and it's really sad to say it because I was there for 2 weeks. My parents came down. 2 weeks later, they came down again, and 2 weeks after that, the season was over.
Right.
So I really wasn't gone for a long time. But it's you know, dealing with struggle and dealing with failure
and
for the first time. Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, you have a lot of confidence, and you've always had success, and now you're struggling. So it was difficult to deal with.
You remember the first game wearing pinstripes?
The first game I went to, I didn't play. Because I sort of got there late, and I went there and just watched. And the first game I played, it was a doubleheader. I was 0 for 8, I think, with 7 strikeouts. I had a few errors and felt like crying between games. If I could have gone into a bathroom, but this is rookie ball, there's no really privacy there. You're out in the open. If I could have, I would have broke down.
At what point do you think you understood the significance of a single digit, given what Yankee Stadium and the monuments and the plaques?
You know, I was well-versed on the Yankee history, but I never thought about it when I got the number 2. My dad wore number 13 in college, and, you know, I always tried to get 13 as much as I could. Jim Leyritz had it when I came up, and the following spring training, they actually changed my number to 17, and because they thought I just didn't want number 2. And I went back and said, whoa, you know, I do want number 2. So I think we could go back to the program in 1997 spring training. I was listed at number 17.
Really?
Yeah.
So you had 2. They put 17.
I got 2 back.
Did you always think that the Yankees fans were the best in the world? Were there days where you're like, can't, back off?
They're tough. They're tough. But I think, you know, it eliminates complacency. You know, I think that's important. You know, you don't ever want to think you haven't made. You know, when I was playing in New York, every day I took the field, I thought I was playing to keep my job. You know, it was a different time.
You felt that way.
No question. I mean, the boss would get rid of you.
Right.
You know, he would get rid of you and get some big-name free agents. So we all felt as though we were playing for a job.
How do you summarize your relationship with George Steinbrenner?
We had a great relationship. I think it started with the Ohio State-Michigan rivalry we had. He was a big Ohio State guy, big Michigan. We used to bet on the football game every year. But, you know, the thing with the boss is, in my opinion, he's the greatest owner of history of sports. I'm a little biased, but you know what he was able to do with this organization and how he's been able to make it grow. And we had the same mindset when it came to winning. You know, if you do not win a championship, then the season is a failure. And you know, I've always felt that way. And, you know, he had a lot of respect. He commanded respect. But if you don't make excuses, you play the game the right way, you play it hard, then he would have respect for you, and therefore we had a great relationship.
Is there a Derek Jeter in your mind, sort of a seminal moment for you that would define your career? And maybe it's one we don't even talk about?
You know, I don't know. There's been so many great memories I've had along the way, and I've been a part of a lot of special moments, and we've won five times. One of the moments, I don't know if it's fair to say, but it's freshest in my mind, was the last game I played at Yankee Stadium, which ironically is the only game in my career where we were mathematically eliminated. So it's the only meaningless game I ever played in Yankee Stadium.
How hard is that to believe?
Yeah, and the way the fans reacted and responded, and you know, it was like playoff atmosphere, and I think it just shows the special bond that I was able to have here with the city of New York and the baseball fans.
What does it mean to have the number retired with the Ruths and the Gehrigs?
It's surreal to think about. I don't know. I'm trying not to think about it. I just want to get there and sort of soak it all in and see how I feel. I don't want to go in there with any preconceived notions of what may happen. I just want to enjoy it. But you know, you have a dream to play professional baseball. You have a dream to play shortstop. You have the dream to play shortstop for the Yankees. To have your number retire was never a part of that dream.
Now, we put together, Josh, a full Derek Jeter podcast. This has all the sound from that Carl Ravitch interview, the sound from Sunday night ceremonies, what other people were saying, what Derek was saying when he visited the Sunday night baseball booth. It's a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, it is, Buster, and we're putting it together. It'll be out a little bit later on this afternoon, but as you said, it's an all-encompassing Derek Jeter call to the legends of sorts. We'll have a full 25-minute interview with Jeter that our good friend Carl did, that you just heard a portion of, along with a lot of other sound. If you're a Yankee fan, a Derek Jeter fan, or just a baseball fan, it'll be worth downloading and listening to that, Buster.
Bleacher Tweets.
All right, Buster. The first Bleacher Tweet of the week comes to us from Dan Esposito. He's at Thought Rebel. And he says, Buster, wouldn't this be the perfect time to try Matt Harvey out as the closer for the Mets? The team's in turmoil, and his career needs a little bit of a rejuvenation.
Yeah, and here's the thing. That might be an idea that if you're on the Mets side, you might think about. But for Matt Harvey, if that actually happened, it would literally cost him tens and tens of millions of dollars, potentially, because he's a free agent after 2018, and closers don't make nearly the kind of money that starting pitchers do. And so I'm sure Matt Harvey probably would go, no.
Yeah, probably. Next one from Jack Urquhart at Jack Urk. He says the Astros are the best team in baseball, as you discussed with Keith Law. What's their ceiling if they don't trade for a starting pitcher this summer?
They could win the World Series, but they also don't have a lot of margin for error for injury, which is why I think they will add pitching during the summer.
Mitchell at Tigers of Detroit would like to know, how hard will it be to choose the NL All-Star first baseman this year with Zimmerman, Thames, Goldschmidt, Votto, Freeman, and Reynolds all at the position?
If you read all those names to Joe Maddon, who, by the way, also has a guy named Anthony Rizzo, he probably would run and hide.
Go to a zoo someplace and get himself a glass of wine. Next one from Greg Hillis at Gregory K. Hillis says, after a five-game winning streak, the Blue Jays, Buster, your Blue Jays are now only four games below 500. Are they back in the playoff hunt?
We're back, man.
Yeah.
You know, that terrible pick. I switched in spring training to the Blue Jays to win the division. Looking brilliant now. I love it.
Yeah, we'll have to ask Gibby if there's room on the bandwagon for you, Buster. Not so fast. And finally, this one from Max Levowitz at MaxLev21. He says, I know it's early, but with the Jeter-Judge comparisons, could you see Judge being the next captain of the Yankees, or is it too soon to have one of those at this time?
I don't think there will be another captain of the Yankees ever. General Manager Brian Cashman said, I can't remember, it was 2014, 2015, that it would be his advice to ownership to never have another captain after Derek Jeter, and I think that'll hold.
Wow. Never's a long time, Buster, but we'll have to wait and see. Keep those Bleacher tweets coming. Use the hashtag Bleacher Tweets.
One last thing.
On this date in baseball history, in 1941, Joe DiMaggio began his 56-game hitting streak with a hit against White Sox pitcher Edgar Smith. And, of course, that would continue on for about 2 months. Think about that, Josh. 2 months' worth of hits. That's absolutely crazy.
It's incredible to think about. It's really hard to comprehend, especially this day and age, how someone could do that. And it's never going to happen again. There's no way.
Okay, we've established you're a Red Sox fan. What'd you think of the Derek Jeter speech?
I thought it was classy, as he is. I mean, you know, I know I can sit up here with my Red Sox hat on and say, oh, Jeter stinks. He doesn't. He's one of the greatest players I've ever seen. He's one of the greatest players I will ever see, and I have nothing but respect for him. I think he did a great job. I think the Yankees did a great job last night. And as someone who is a fan of sports and as a fan of baseball, I'm glad I got to watch it.
And I can tell you this, you know, when throughout his career, Derek would always have to, he'd be the target of people saying that he was overrated. You know who absolutely laughed at all that? Folks in the Red Sox front office.
Oh, of course.
Like, I know those guys, and they go, are you kidding? This guy is relentless. They love Derek Jeter, and they appreciated him in the same way that the Yankees did. Well, that's it for today. My thanks to Carl Ravitch for that great interview that he did with Derek Jeter, to Todd Radom, to Keith Law, and to Josh Macri, who produced this podcast every day. Have a great day, everybody, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
Daddy, where do babies come from?
Honey?
Mommy went to the store.
Oh, well, you see, well, there's a mommy and a daddy, right?
Right.
And see, when they call Geico, they could save a bunch of money on car insurance.
Oh, really? And that makes them happy?
Yes, that makes them very happy.
That's good.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we could have this talk, sunshine.
Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.